Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, thanks for tuning in to After Six. We're happy to have back with us a very fun guest to talk to because he's so smart, Jeffrey Tucker. He's the editorial director of AIER. I think it's American Institute of Economic Research. Is that right, Jeff?
That's correct.
And you write amazing columns on politics. It's fun to read them and then talk to you about them. And your most recent one is on the 70% tax rate proposed by the left and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez because the wealthy don't pay their fair share. And one of the things I'm struck by reading your column is that we seem to always discuss politics in this country with one side of the ledger being looked at, one argument, without anyone ever mentioning what the other sides would be. So your column does a good job, I think, of going through some of the repercussions. What would the costs be of having a 70% tax rate?
I think what would the cost be? Well, I think in this case, if anybody tried to impose a 70% tax rate today, there would be a revolution, actually. I don't know how else to put it because, there's a couple of factors. We used to have a 70% tax rate. Nobody actually paid that because there were so many loopholes and so many exceptions. The effective rate was really different from the statutory rate. I think the effective rate, was closer to 35-38% back when the statutory rate was 70%. So that's a and when the you remember in the throughout the 60s all the way through the 80s the statutory rate kept falling and falling and falling, but at the same time there were other avenues for avoiding taxes were closed. They were closing loopholes. So it actually there hasn't been much change in taxes since the end of World War II, actually.
So in the real dollars being paid by real people, real rich people, they're still paying about the same amount. And this is one of the natural repercussions is rich people are connected, and if they're getting gouged because they're the evil rich, then they call up their friends, the evil politicians, and the two of them make a deal on how to allow them to avoid the taxes.
Sure. I mean, this is the way the system works. I mean, the system is run by rich people, actually. Like, people don't get that. Like, you always hear government talking about how government should serve the poor. Let's say I agree. The reality is that the poor don't run government. The rich run government. And so there's always a workaround. So this is a sheer fantasy on the part of the Democrats. And actually, the funny thing about this proposal, the 70% proposal, is that it's being endorsed, actually, by people on the right, too, because people on the, not on the left, but on the right, are really upset at Silicon Valley. They're upset at the Koch brothers. They're upset at the billionaire classes for not adopting Trump-style politics, so they kind of want them punished too. So everybody's kind of got the long knives out for the rich right now. But here's the other thing I mentioned in my column that nobody wants to talk about. And this is, I think this is, probably if somebody came up to me, what's the most significant fact about public life in the last half century? I would say this. The approval for government, or the confidence that government has the ability to do the right thing, or the willingness to do the right thing, has fallen from 77% in 1964 to 18% today. In other words, government is deeply unpopular. No matter your political ideology, whether you're on the left or the right, people don't trust the government to do it.
So in other words, back then, people figured if they were paying taxes, that money was going to be put to good use, and now they are near universally opposed to that thought.
Of course. Yeah. No, I mean, so you have to kind of put yourself back and say 1964 and imagine what was going on at the time. The moonshot was quite impressive. There's still the memory of the win of World War II. The Greatest Generation was you know, had been running things. People had some confidence in people like Dwight Eisenhower as a president. And, you know, there was a kind of respectable aspect to government back in those days. I mean, I don't think it was justified, but
the illusion was there.
But yeah, there was a widespread impression that, oh, well, they claim they can run the country. Let's give them a chance. Well, we gave them a chance and it didn't work. You know, in the meantime, think about all this happened. I mean, we had the Vietnam War, the draft, which really snapped a whole generation out of the illusion that government was a nice guy. When you get drafted and told you have to go off and kill people, that's not a very nice thing. Then you had the public schools got messed with by the government. Then you had urban planning. You had the insolvency of the Social Security system happening. You had the ballooning of the deficit, you know, with scandal after scandal from Watergate going forward. Then you had a hyperinflation. If anything proved the government can't manage the economy, it was a hyperinflation of the late 1970s. And since then, we've had one banking crisis after another. Most recently, 2008, where the Federal Reserve just bailed out all the big banks and told everybody to forget it. So we know the truth about government today. Regardless of political ideology, people know the truth about government. I mean, it's never on record ever been as unpopular as it is today. Government as an institution is deeply unpopular. It's never been as unpopular as it is today.
And what would you say is the underpinning of that? We're talking to Jeffrey Tucker.
Oh,
from
I'll tell you what it is.
I just want to I want to have everybody running to your website. It's AIER.org, and Jeffrey's the editorial director there. So he writes wonderful columns. Other people do as well. But if you want to see a small government rational perspective, it's a good place to go. I'm sorry, Jeff. Go ahead.
No, thank you. But, you know, the reason for it is the collapse of the paradigm. The perception in the past that we've got your back. You know, we're going to run a war and we're going to win it and we're going to convert this country over on the other side of the world to become a constitutional democracy. We're going to take care of you from cradle to grave. We're going to reform health care and make it wonderful and make it possible for you to get all the services you want at very low prices. We're going to create beautiful public schools and so on and so on. We're going to deliver the mail. You don't have to worry about anything. Government's going to take care of everything. That whole paradigm has been completely shattered after one failure after another, domestically and internationally. Government is now widely seen to be the institution that doesn't do anything right. And by the way, this goes for the employees of government, too. So if you look at the polls concerning job happiness, government is at the very bottom. Like,
wait, government workers, you mean?
Yeah, government workers are...
They're not happy?
They're the least fans of government of anybody, the people who actually work here, because they know the system better than anybody, and they'll tell you, you know, horrifying stories of misery. They only stick around because the benefits are so good and
You can tell when you go to the motor vehicle department, there is a malaise in the air. And I think that malaise speaks to people who are stuck in a place where cause and effect doesn't function. And
that's right.
That's our perception of what government is. It's this place where the stupidity of bureaucracy wins out over serving the customer, because there is no customer. There's just people who you take their money away when you need it.
Yeah, they're just told what to do, and they grudgingly do it. And by the way, the DMV is awesome compared to free. Can you imagine what it must be like at the Department of Labor, the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Housing and Urban Development? I used to hang around that building. That is the most depressing place you've ever been in your life.
Why?
Nobody
what do you
likes
mean?
It. Oh, it's the workers are they have to show up, and they have to build these horrible buildings. You know, I don't know if you've been to Washington D.C., but the bureaucracies are miserable places. Like windowless, dim lights, they stink. Everything stinks inside. It's all old fashioned. You feel like you're in the military or something. It's just horrible. I can't even imagine what it'd be like to be living in Virginia and like, oh, good morning. Now it's time for me to take the metro into downtown D.C. And then for what? So you slog in, climb to the 18th floor in your windowless office and sit there doing nothing? until you watch the clock and then, oh, well, you can take a two-hour lunch. And then you come back and you sit there some more and sort of vaguely sleep. And then finally, 5 o'clock rolls around. You have to get back on the bus and go back home again. What is your life worth? It's terrible. You know, you look out at the private sector, people are making things, they're building things, they're selling things, everything's really fun and exciting, happy. Wow, the challenges, you know. It's not like that in government. I mean, this is a miserable, miserable institution.
Well, you know, it's funny. The other day we were discussing on the show the notion of a shutdown and what that actually means. And I was going through different departments and looking up how they describe their own mission. And first of all, most Americans have no idea what most of these departments do. And
for sure.
There's no reason to know, because for most of us, they have no apparent function that's productive to our lives.
That is a truth that you just said. I mean, like, most people don't actually encounter the government. And now you go to Washington, D.C., and so what does the shutdown involve? It means you can't go to the museums. This is what most people encounter with federal government, aside from paying their annual
tax. Yeah, you don't get to see the pandas at the zoo.
Yeah, you don't get to go, and you don't get to go to the Air and Space Museum. There's some really cool museums there, the Art and Industry Museum, and really cool things, but they're all shut down. And, you know, I looked up the history of the Smithsonian. This all came about because there's this very wealthy British guy named Smithson, and he had a lot of money. And so he gave, sent at his death, willed, I don't know, I think it's like today's equivalent of about $11 million, to the United States to build a great museum honoring American history because he loved America. So Andrew Jackson sent over some assistant to go and pick up the money. They picked up the money. They brought it back. And guess what happened then? It's unbelievable. They brought back all these bags of gold coins. They invested them in Arkansas bonds, state bonds for Arkansas. What a scam. And the state defaulted on those bonds. And so they lost all the money.
I knew you were going to say that.
I know. It's such a classic case. It's like, oh, wow, that's what happens. So there's every indication that Mr. Smithson intended these things to be private, you know, like a nice private foundation set up. Instead, it's basically stolen by the government, invested in Arkansas state bonds. The whole thing goes belly up. So Congress felt kind of bad about that. Oh, whoops, that's a bad thing. So they voted to restore the money. But because Congress voted to restore the money, they said, okay, so Congress is going to run it because we are paying for it. So that's when you get the public Smithsonian Museum. So they've been public ever since. Well, it's ridiculous. Now, you know, the government shut down, so they shut all the museums. That, to me, I think the ideal thing to do right now would just be simply sell them. I mean, wouldn't Apple love to be the owner of the technology museum? You know, you can think of, you know, probably Bill Gates would love to buy the National Zoo. I mean, there's a ton of money, private money out there that would love to take over the Smithsonian and open those doors and run them like consumer services and just be awesome when you never have to worry about it again.
So we're talking to Jeff Tucker, editorial director of AIER, the American Institute for Economic Research. And I love this conversation about we started off with Jeff's column on the 70%, the taxing of the 70s at a rate of 70% for the rich, because that's what the left is proposing right now. And and one of the things that we don't think about is what happens to that money. And you make an argument that I always make, so it makes me feel smarter. And that is that, why would you ever want to take money away from Bill Gates or take money away from Steve Jobs or any of the great industrialists who are technically the evil rich? Why would you take money from them to give it to the morbidly obese bureaucracy in Washington?
Right. It's a very bad idea. And what are you taking away? And what are you missing out on? You're missing out on investments. You're missing out on charity. Like, most philanthropy in this country comes from the 1%, actually. Like, if you started actually having an effective rate of 70%, it would destroy every charity in this country, every museum, churches, nonprofits, Feed the Children, libraries.
But why would that be a problem, given that government is the home of compassion?
Yeah, that's right. So, well, just imagine if we had to rely on government for our symphonies, our museums, our churches, the charities that you believe in. You know, government can't run any of these things. A 70% tax rate would destroy compassion in this country. It would substitute philanthropy. It would ruin philanthropy and replace it with violent bureaucracies. And it's ironic that it's being pushed by the left. You think that the left would be caring about the poor and stuff? Well, this would, and care about the arts, care about humanities, you know, and so on. This would be a catastrophe for America's charitable sector. And, you know, this is a very generous country. I think last year, I guess, Americans gave something crazy like $440 billion to charity. I mean, it's just, we are a very interesting people. Like, we believe in philanthropy. We believe in charity. But most of that comes from the very rich. And I get it, right? You get rich enough, you can't consume anymore. You want to do some good for the world. Well, fortunately, we have nonprofit charities out there to do it, so you give your money away. And it's a beautiful system. So you start taxing the 70% rate, you're going to gut every charity, every philanthropy, every church, every private hospital, symphonies, you know, art.
So what you're describing, it seems to me, Jeff, is that if you were to raise the tax rates dramatically on the wealthy, what you would be doing is taking power out of the hands of Americans and putting it into the hands of the government, which is the opposite of
our... A government that everybody is convinced, according to all the polls, people do not trust the government to do the right thing. So this would be a deeply, appallingly unpopular.
Isn't everybody understanding right now that... When they hear the left talking about all the things they want to do, they want free college, they want free health care,
yeah,
they want to oppressively tax the rich so they can pay for all these wonderful things. Meanwhile, nobody's talking about cutting any budget, cutting any spending, and the most of the states and the federal government are all hugely in debt. Nobody's talking about using any of this new revenue they fantasize about to actually make us whole.
No, and, you know, I disagree with all these policies, but what really matters is that this is a kind of a political catastrophe for the left. You know, think about it. The Democrats, you know, barely got hold of the House of Representatives. It's like, okay, now we're in charge of the House of Representatives. That's great. What do we want to do? Well, we want to pillage everyone with this high tax rate and spend it on a bunch of stupid government programs. I mean, this is what buried the Democratic Party. I mean, this is how Reagan wiped the floor with these people. Just simply called them tax and spend. You people don't have any better ideas for anything except tax, 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 and spend, spend, spend.
But I think
it's
the construct.
Criticism.
I think your construct, Jeff, of connecting their idea of coming into office and behaving the same way they did 50 years ago,
yeah,
when people believed in government. Now
that's
that
right,
they don't believe in government anymore,
right,
isn't that a political suicide pact for the left?
It's politically catastrophic. And if you talk to really serious, sophisticated people who are on the left or the Democratic Party, they had their heads in their hands when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez would start blabbing on about this. Because they said, oh, my God, this is the worst messaging you could ever have. It's going to be a political disaster. And that... So I'm of two views about that, because I'm not a fan of Trump. I'm not a fan of the new Republican Party. I'm more a fan of the old Republican Party, like Reagan and so on. So I don't really like the way things are going. And I would like to see the Democrats become a viable, creative, serious competitor to the Republicans on a national level. But they're not going to do it like this. It's so sad. I think what you have in the Democratic Party is a tremendous intellectual failure. It's like they literally can't think of anything else to do except bloat to the size of government, create more bureaucracies, and pillage more private wealth from people. That is just, in 2019, not a viable political strategy.
But why? I'm curious about what is wrong on a policy level with what Republicans are doing today compared with 30 or 40 years ago.
Well, 34 years ago, and I don't know if you want to get into the immigration thing, but I would like to see, first of all, this country desperately needs immigration, and we need legal immigration, we need more work permits, and we need more talent coming in from abroad, and shutting things down on the way Trump is doing is just not a good way to do it. I was raised in Texas on the border, and the idea of sticking a wall in the middle of a river, it makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah, well, I don't think anything's going to end up there. So I hear you on that, and I, too, love what happens with vibrant immigration. But
But
immigration has been suicidal for the past 50 years, since 65.
Suicidal politically for the Republicans. But it's true. But that's a kind of a different topic and a very complicated
yes.
one. But,
no, I don't want to get us off into that because we need to wrap up. But
a much more outrageous thing is what Trump has done with the taxes on aluminum and steel, which has massively raised prices for American business and put GM and Harley-Davidson, under serious stress. The ruination of our trade relations with China has actually harmed American companies like Apple. American car manufacturers begged Trump to stop with this trade war stuff. He didn't listen. Tens of thousands of American businesses went to Congress and said to him, can you please stop this? He wouldn't listen. So he shattered all kind of global supply chains and ruined all sorts of trading relationships that were growing and developing. And we were making progress towards a no-tariff world. And then this guy comes along and just ruins relationships with countries around the world, inspiring all kinds of retaliation. American manufacturers have lost markets abroad, especially agricultural markets. I mean, our soybean industry has been shattered and destroyed. He's had to bail out farmers with successive rounds of $15, $18 billion subsidies just to make up for their lost markets abroad. The Trump trade policy has been so costly and so unnecessary. The Wall Street Journal, I think, called it a few days ago correctly. They said, and I find this extraordinary, that the pressure on the financial markets as we experienced all throughout 2018 began in March and lasted all the way to the end of the year. This is the exact month to the day when Trump started his trade wars. So it's harmed your 401k. It's made America relatively poor. It's harmed growth, and ironically, seriously harmed domestic manufacturing and agriculture. And it's just bad policies. And Republicans have always been for more trade, more free trade, and that's what we've been pushing ever since the disastrous 1930 tariff called Smoot-Hawley that drove us into the Great Depression.
All right, Jeff, we're out of time, so I've got to wrap up with you. It's fascinating to talk with you once again. We will reach out another time as well and see if we can do this again.
All right, sounds good. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeffrey Tucker, editorial director of AIER. Go to AIER.org and read his material there. Thank you, Jeff.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Wow, always fun to talk with Jeffrey Tucker. Always good to have you here. Stay tuned. We've got news next, then Clark Howard on WTIC News Talk 1080.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.